Welcome back to the program. Few people understand President Obama better than our guest, Jonathan Alter. He's covered Obama since his days in Chicago. He wrote an early Newsweek cover story that helped bring Obama to national prominence and has been one of the preeminent chroniclers of Obama's campaign and, more importantly, its connection to the Obama presidency. Over the years, there have been several books central to our understanding of politics. Theodore White's Making of the President, Clifton White's Suite 3505, Joe McGinnis's Selling of the President 1968, and Hunter Thompson's Fear and Loathing on the 1972 campaign trail. Now Jonathan Alter, award-winning reporter and columnist, former senior editor for Newsweek, adds his new book, The Center Holds, to this distinguished list. It is my pleasure to welcome Jonathan Alter back to this program to talk about The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies. Jonathan Alter, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Jeff. I'm just thrilled that you would put me in the company of those authors who I've revered since I was a kid.
And well, haven't we all, and you deserve it. I want to talk, first of all, about what the seeming disconnect that we see between the Obama campaigns, particularly this one, and the Obama presidency. In some ways, you would expect there to be a link, and yet in some ways they couldn't be further apart.
Well, it's a very good point. It's almost a kind of a paradox, but there are some explanations. It's much harder to get your message out as president than it is in a campaign where everybody is looking on a daily basis for what you want to say that day, what you want to say against your opponent, which foot you want to put forward. But when there's no campaign on and there's a lot else going on, even though the president has a bully pulpit, it's much harder for him to drive a consistent message. But in some ways, that lets the president off the hook too much. He has had trouble communicating almost from day one. And the book is quite complimentary in some ways, but also quite critical in other ways. And I am critical of him for not developing a shrewder communication strategy, starting with Obamacare and moving on through some of his other programs. So I think that's part of what's at issue here. And then I'd say the other factor is that, if you are in a campaign mode, you can work the political angles much more directly. When you're president, sometimes you have to do things that you know are not necessarily very good for you politically, but that you need to do long term in order to do the job right. So you're going to be better politically in a campaign than you will be in office, generally speaking.
And yet, one of the other ironies and the other paradoxes in all of this goes to the heart of what you're saying in terms of this ability to get the message out. One, Obama being someone that came to prominence with respect to his sense of oratory, his sense of being able to explain a message, and also talking about this campaign, as you do, where they struggled for a long time with message and finally came upon something in terms of defending the middle class that he was able to use to connect with people. And consistently during the course of governing, never seems to find that thread of a message that he found so successfully during the campaign.
Well, it's almost like he separates governing and politics. And one of the great ironies to me is that this is a president who has been spectacularly successful politically. He's the first president in 50 years and the first Democrat since Franklin Roosevelt to win twice with a majority. In other presidencies, there have been third-party candidates or other things that came up that prevented Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and others from getting a majority twice. So that's the ultimate definition of political success. And yet he doesn't really like politics very much, and he disdains a lot of the theatricality that's a part of politics and the backslapping. And it's almost like he forgets that old line that we all remember from The Godfather when Hyman Roth, mobster, says, this is the business we've chosen. And he sometimes forgets that you know, he has to be in that business all the time, and that you need to be politically shrewd as president. It's not just a matter of making fancy speeches, because that alone doesn't really get it done. But it's also true that when the president's in a down phase the way he is now, people tend to look at the glass half empty. And, you know, he's had a lot of problems in the last 6 weeks. But if you look at his record over the last 4.5 years, he's gotten a tremendous amount done. He got more done than Bill Clinton did in 8 years legislatively, and much more than John F. Kennedy, for instance, did. So, you know, it's important to keep that in perspective. And it's not just Obamacare. It's a whole series of other bills that he was able to get through in the first couple of years.
And it's interesting when one looks at how he deals with governing in the context of politics. And you talk about what he does between, you know, 10 p.m. and 1 a.m. Well, Bill Clinton used to use that time for politics. He uses it more for governing, for preparation, as you talk about.
Right. So, you know, Clinton would be on the phone reaching out to people, and that was important for him, although it didn't prevent him from getting impeached. Obama has ESPN on in the background. He's going over position papers, preparing for the next day, and he's enormously well-prepared for his job. And he's, you know, he's very, very on top of the substance of what he needs to do, as was Clinton. And that Clinton managed to do both, be on top of the substance and be political. Obama is just wired a little differently because he's not a needy politician himself. He doesn't always or even usually realize that these other politicians really need that call from him. They really need him checking in, reaching out, and he's leaving a tool in the toolbox when he doesn't schmooze enough. So I've got a chapter called Missing the Schmooze Gene. He's just missing that ability to backslap. He can, when he needs to, he can do it and be, of course, the enormously charming man that we all have come to know. But it's not something that he does naturally. I think he's also, in terms of his speeches, he's worried about raising expectations too high, which is something that happened when he came into office. So he often is trying to ratchet down expectations, and in doing that, doesn't really manage the expectations very well. But again, this is partly a kind of a you know, glass half empty analysis. As I said, there's also my, you know, the center holes. My book is full of things he did right as well as wrong.
Right.
So it's a mixed bag.
And it's interesting when you talk about the center holds and Obama in many ways seeing his role as the protector of the social contract. We really see him in a traditional political sense as a kind of small C conservative, and the Republicans and those in Congress that want to do away with 50 years of legislation as being the more radical. And yet that conservative small C position has engendered such hostility towards him.
That is right. And that's really why it's called the center holds, is that the president, in this case, on a historical continuum, is the small C conservative defender and protector of the 20th century progressive achievements that were eventually accepted by both parties for a long time. Social Security, Medicare, college loans. These things were not really argued about much. Yes, they could be strengthened along the margins. Yes, some liberals have been too resistant to tinkering with these programs a little bit to strengthen them for the future. But the Republican Party is in a very different place. This is not your father's Republican Party. And as Bob Dole said, you know, they need to put a sign on the door, closed for repairs, because this party got so far over to the right in the 2011-2012 period that it lost touch with the American people. And if they had won, which was quite possible, much more likely than people realized at the time, then we would be living in a very different kind of country, and we would be much farther over to the right than we are now. So as upset as people are by what's happened in the last couple of months, you know, I argue that the United States dodged a bullet last November, and that if we had elected Romney and Ryan, whose Ryan plan, informed by the writing of Ayn Rand and radical libertarians, would have, for a variety of reasons, been largely enacted, and we would be slashing programs that we had agreed on as a country by not by 5 or 10%, but by 40, 50, 60%, or zeroing them out altogether. And as Ryan said, we would be rewriting the American social contract, which is a very radical thing to do.
And as you point out, even Bill Clinton told Romney after the campaign that he thought up until Hurricane Sandy, he had a good shot to win it.
That's right. He said that you know, it's possible that Clinton was just kind of trying to be nice to Romney after he lost, but he did say to him that he thought he'd had a likely shot of winning until Sandy. I don't think that's actually true. I think the second debate, when Obama was able to come back, in part because of Benghazi, interestingly, he led Romney right into a trap. I think at that point the election was probably over, even before Sandy. But after the first debate, it was quite possible that Obama would lose. And I try to pull back the curtain and take people where they can't go. In the debate prep, for instance, where Obama was 0-for-6 against John Kerry playing Mitt Romney, and his advisors all knew that he was going to blow that debate for reasons that I explain in the book. But he had a cushion at that point, which was from the 47% incident. He had a 7-point lead going into that first debate. If it had not been for Scott Prudy, the bartender who changed history, who I spent a lot of time with and got very interested in his motivation for what he did with that famous videotape, if it had not been for him and Obama had been, say, roughly even with Romney going into the first debate, and he had lost as badly as he did, it might have been very, very hard for him to catch up.
I want to talk a little bit about that debate, but before that, the story of Scott Prudy that begins in Florida is a remarkable story. Share that with us, Jonathan.
Well, it's a story that actually begins on a pitch-black night in the Everglades in 2005, and a woman plunged into a canal in her car, and the car sunk to the bottom of the canal. And Scott was working at a motorcycle dealership nearby, and he heard the accident, and he sprinted there, and a man had broken his arm trying to free the woman to open the door of the car. And when Scott got there, the passerby and others told him that it was no use, that she had drowned, and they couldn't get her out. And Scott jumped in the canal and finally was able to get the door open. Then he got out and got a knife, and he cut the seatbelt. He freed this woman and was decorated as a hero, and she lived. And then 7 years later, he's at this fundraiser for Mitt Romney, and he's brought his camera and he decides to videotape him. And then afterward, he doesn't look at the tape for 2 weeks. And when he finally, in the middle of the night, he goes into the bathroom and he looks in the mirror and he says, "You're an effing coward." And then and begins to post little bits of the tape, and then finally gives the whole thing to Mother Jones magazine. But it's a really compelling story of this bartender with a conscience, and I spent many hours talking to him. And at one point, he brought up the incident in the Everglades, and he said, you know, I realized after that, if you can jump in, you must jump in. And he felt he had an obligation to try to prevent Mitt Romney from becoming president.
And part of what motivated him was this talk went in the early part of Romney's speech about buying this factory in China, buying this company in China.
Yeah, it was not about the 47% principally. What first offended him was that early in the tape, Romney talks about buying an appliance factory in China, and Romney says the women were working for a pittance, and it was 100 young women to a toilet. And so Scott kept waiting for him to say, and then I bought the factory and we improved the working conditions. But he never said that. It was kind of like, well, this is great. You know, we were able to get all this profit out of this sweatshop. And Scott Prudy said, well, you know, he's standing in the other room at the bar with this camera on, and he said he felt like yelling, hey, Mitt, would you like your wife working there? And he found himself wondering, are we going to have this in the United States where the capital just exploits labor to this degree? And so he got very interested in Chinese labor issues, and before he wanted to surface with his own name, which wasn't until after the election, he adopted as his email and for on his Twitter accounts the name Anne, Anonymous, and he posted a picture that was taken from a book called Factory Girl of a young Chinese woman worker, and this burly 38-year-old bartender took on the identity of a young Chinese woman who had been exploited, and he got so interested in it that after he surfaced earlier this year, after a period of unemployment, because as he knew he would lose his job as a result of what he did, he now has a job working on international labor issues. And in fact, currently he's in Bangladesh working to try to draw attention to unfair labor practices. So, you know, there's a whole story of class struggle, the theme of makers versus takers, which is embedded not just in the 47% story, but in the story of the 2012 campaign. And so I really wanted it to be more than just a horse race book. I wanted it to be a story about where America is right now in terms of the way we infuse our politics with class interests, which we did in this campaign more than in any campaign, I think, since 1972, when Nixon actually used the 47% in his ads. You can believe it. He used that exact figure in television ads, which I found fascinating. And this this idea of class struggle in some ways goes back to the 1896 campaign between William Jennings Bryan and William McKinley. And so I try to, without dwelling too much on the history, to, as often as I can, put 2012 in historical context.
And Obama sensed this. You talk about the moment that he heard in a focus group this comment a woman made about this being a make-or-break moment for the middle class.
So Obama's people heard a woman in Ohio say in a focus group that it was a make-or-break moment for the middle class, and they were struggling some on message. And that crystallized it for them, and then you heard that line in a lot of the president's speeches, and much of the policy and much of the politics then revolved around this question of trying to restore the middle class. Now, I think your listeners might go, well, they're not getting it done right now on that, although the economy is coming back. But this goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning. Mm-hmm. In some ways, this was a defensive election that if the Republican vision had prevailed, we would have moved much more sharply against the middle class. So at one point, after the Occupy Wall Street movement, Mitt Romney said, you know, it's wrong, this is class warfare, these issues should only be discussed in quiet rooms. And Warren Buffett said, yeah, it is class warfare. It's our class, the wealthy, against everybody else, and we're winning. And if Romney had won the election, that victory in the class war over the last 25 years would have become a rout, and they would have cut taxes again for the wealthy, slashed these programs for the middle class, slashed things like education, making it harder to go to college and get a toehold in the middle class, and right on down the line. So I've covered 9 presidential elections, and I thought this one was the most consequential. Every 4 years, some candidate piously says, this is the most important election of my lifetime, and I kind of sit there and go, yeah, I've heard this before. But this time I really thought it was, and the reason is, just imagine that Romney is president right now, and the economy's headed back up. There's some encouraging signs in the American economy. The conclusion that most people would have drawn was, oh, well, of course, because we got rid of that Jimmy Carter, Barack Obama guy, and, you know, now we have a business-friendly president, and there would have been a false cause and effect. Well, we slashed taxes for the wealthy, we slashed regulation, we slashed programs for the poor, and now the economy's headed back up. And that would have discredited progressive ideas for a generation. And we would now, if progressives think that they're a little bit, you know, frustrated now, they should just engage in a thought experiment and think about what they would be feeling right now if the election returns had gone differently.
You spent time reporting on both candidates. Why was Mitt Romney such a bad candidate all the way through the election?
Well, I think that he, I think that there were a few things at work, some of them psychological that I tried to probe a little bit. His father had been governor of Michigan, and his political career ended in 1968 when he was the front runner for the Republican presidential nomination. And he made a gaffe. He said he had been brainwashed in Vietnam when he visited there as governor. And so Romney developed a terrible fear of making a gaffe, but it was almost like, don't think of a pink elephant, don't think of a pink elephant, don't think of a pink elephant, and then you think of a pink elephant, right? And so he became almost comically gaffe-prone. And he also was determined not to repeat his father's other mistakes. His father was a moderate, and his father criticized conservatives in the party, and that didn't work out so well for him. So Romney would never criticize even the most outlandish statements from you know, people like Rush Limbaugh. And so he got himself kind of isolated over on the right during the primaries, and it was very, very hard for him to get back to the center, because he had said things like, you know, we should have self-deportation and other ridiculous things that made it very hard for him to be competitive, and he ended up only getting 29% of the Latino vote. But he also, and this was the thing that puzzled me the most, he is a self-described numbers guy, but he could not bring big data analytics to his campaign. So he ran essentially what his own people called a Mad Men campaign, where they were using ad guys from the Reagan era and Obama ran a Bain campaign with the latest state-of-the-art analytics run by these 20-something geeks out of what they call the cave in Chicago, this secret annex to the headquarters, where they kept their what they thought of as their nuclear codes on how to crack the code on everything from internet fundraising, which they increased tenfold, to a much more efficient field organization. And there was this geek gap, as I call it, between the two campaigns that was horrible for Romney. He was running a kind of a mid-20th century campaign, and Obama was running the first true digital campaign of the 21st century.
And even when the Romney campaign had the opportunity, when Alex Gage came to them with some ideas, they rejected him.
Yeah, this is a fun scene. So there's a guy named Alex Gage, who, longtime Republican opinion survey research expert, who actually invented the term micro-targeting some years ago. And he went to the Romney campaign, where his wife, Packer Gage, was the deputy campaign manager. So he was very well connected. And he made this proposal to them for what they called Romney Abacus, which was a big data campaign along the lines of what they were doing in Chicago. And when he got to the meeting, he realized that all the Romney high command were on their Blackberries and, you know, otherwise distracted, and they weren't paying any attention to what he was saying, and they rejected it because they felt, as one told me, that, you know, well, the quants, the geeks, had not been able to predict the subprime mortgage crisis. How are they possibly going to help reelect or elect a president? And that the whole thing was a bunch of hype. And I have to say, at the beginning of the campaign, when I was talking to Jim Messina in Chicago, the Obama campaign manager, and he was telling me how much money they were investing in digital, and I was thinking, well, what if this is a bunch of hooey? You know, why are they doing this? Is this a pig in a poke, and there's no time for Obama 2.0? And it seemed really risky. But the more I learned about it, the more I realized it was really central to winning the campaign. And so I tried to translate the tech talk from the original geek into English for readers, and it turned out it was a very exciting and colorful story, and they had a motley collection of people in the cave, not just data scientists, but biophysicists and a child prodigy, three professional poker players who figured out how to re-engineer American politics.
Nate Silver writ large. I want to conclude by coming back to kind of where we started and talking about this complexity between Obama's governing and campaign. Now that there are no more campaigns on the horizon, now that the importance of re-election doesn't loom large the way it did for Obama previously, how do you see this, if at all, changing his governing, changing him, changing the way he approaches things for the rest of this term?
I think he's going to be less guarded. We saw it recently on judges, for instance, and, you know, when they were blocking his judges, he came out, he took some shots at the Republicans on the Hill, and he was a little bit more confrontational. I think he could go even further than that, but he doesn't have to worry as much about the repercussions of that, having been reelected. And he knows, and the country should know, that nothing particularly conservative is going to happen. He has the veto pen. And they can't override his veto. So nothing particularly progressive might happen, although I think there's going to be immigration reform, which would be a big accomplishment for him. But we're not going to see the politics of 2011. Even if there are these confrontations over the budget, there's not going to be a grand bargain. If they want to shut down the government, it might hurt, depending on how it's played, depending on how some of these current controversies play out, it could hurt the president's popularity. But that's not ultimately as relevant as it was before the election, when he had to worry about losing the whole thing. I mean, if we had a parliamentary system, then the president's kind of popularity at various points would be more relevant. But he's there and for 3.5 more years.
Jonathan Alter, the book is The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies, just out from Simon & Schuster. Jonathan, always a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending time with us.
This was really fun. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.